think you all know my name. I'm Shanti Rubinstone. At least you know that. How many of you have ever been to one of my talks before? I know you haven't. And you've been here too. Great. I didn't remember that. Good. So let's see. It would be very nice if I could see all of your faces.
I can't see yours.
Yes, that's really important, actually. Good. Yeah, so I'm glad. If you just move around until I can see your face. And I asked many years ago to quit being introduced here. They always said so many things. I was anxious by the time I started talking, feeling like I had to live up to or into something. And this actually feels much better, just to be this way with all of you. I am, as you probably read in the little bio that they do of each speaker, a physician. I've been a physician all of my adult life. Actually, that's not totally true. For the first 14 years of adult life, I was a nurse, which I love. I mean, here we are talking about love, and it's something they teach nurses about, but they don't really honestly teach doctors much about, or at least they didn't in those days. And usually when I'm here, the subject is something cleverly, supposedly, about healing or health or wellness. But I will tell you all, and you're all at East West, so that says something. No matter what I talk about, in the end, we're talking about some aspect of the divine. It just has to be that way for me. So I always feel like people walk in and they don't know that, and they're now thinking I'm going to talk about romantic love or something, which I am, by the way, going to start there. But even though it's a small group, and I don't mean this, this isn't glib or facetious, but I want to feel free to talk about love tonight the way I'd like to talk about love. So if it doesn't sit with anybody, don't feel badly if you have to get up and leave. And I know that sounds funny or silly, but it's totally okay. It's easier to leave when this room is packed with 50. It's a little harder when there's 15 of us. So, but feel free. Hi, welcome. I had just an interesting, I can't do this. I didn't think I could. I had an interesting little, I was meditating outside by the Buddha a little bit ago, and I was remembering something that happened to me a couple of weeks ago. I am a physician, as I've told you. I'm still practicing a little bit of medicine just to keep my hands in it. I go to Kaiser a few times, about 5 or 6 times a month, because I'm at that age where if I didn't do it in about 6 months, I wouldn't have any of those memories anymore. Too many words and diagnoses and medicines, and the fund of knowledge is huge. So just, I'm not quite ready to say I'm done practicing medicine, so I do go to Kaiser, but my biggest practice is this practice that I was talking to you about that's called transformational medicine. So I see people have medical problems, emotional problems, spiritual problems, doesn't matter to me. Who are interested in finding an expansive, creative, optimistic way of solving their problems so that we quit looking, as my spiritual teacher says, there are no such thing as obstacles, there are only opportunities. And that's what I do now for a living, and it's really quite wonderful. But my big job in the world is that I'm a minister at the Ananda Church, which is really a spiritual community based on the teachings of this man, Yogananda. So I'm one of the ministers there, and I give a fair number of Sunday sermons, but I'm also the manager of the church. I do a lot. I'm telling you all of this for a reason. A couple of weeks ago, I was sitting in service, waiting for it to start. I was not going to be giving service that day, but rather Asha Praver, who maybe some of you know, was. But still many of us get into our robes because at the end we do a blessing. So those of us who are in robes but not giving the sermon are sitting in the front row. And Asha got up as other early parts of the service were going on. There's music, there's readings, and she went back and she walked out through the minister's door. And she just didn't come back. And the music was going and then the readings were going. So it just is my role at the church that if she didn't come back, I would be the one to stand up and give a sermon. When there's a problem, that's when I step in. So I was sitting there and I was thinking, this is very interesting. I don't even know what the reading is today, because I don't read it ahead of time if I'm not giving the sermon. And I was sitting there thinking, okay, Shanti, if she doesn't come back, you're on, and what are you going to talk about? So I listened to the first couple of lines of the sermon, and I said to myself, if Asha doesn't come back today, I will talk about what would happen in our lives. This is what I said to myself. If we looked at what was going on in our lives and accepted all of it as being just perfect, if we looked at our lives and we said, this is what I have, this is what I've drawn, but it's not like, so it's not like a conscious thing necessarily, we all know that. But it is true that energetically we draw certain people to ourselves, certain experiences. I mean, we have to. It's everything that happens in our life. And it's part of what I want to talk about tonight. We talk about love and relationships and what's the reason for them and how can we most beneficially use them and all like that. We'll get into that. But it just came to me to talk about that. How would our lives change if suddenly we just said, everything I have is perfect? And as soon as that thought came to me, although I hadn't planned a sermon, I just totally relaxed. I thought, okay, that's fine. I could get up and talk about that for 25 minutes. And as soon as I had that thought, Asha walked back out. And I swear to you, and this is really the truth, you could go to the AnandaPaloAlto.org website, listen to her talk, I think it was 2 weeks ago. What do you think she talked about? Exactly that. That is, she literally started her talk by saying, what if we decided to look at our lives as being perfect, just exactly as they are? How would that change everything? It was so mind-blowing to me, literally mind-blowing. I don't even often refer to Yogananda in a talk and directly, and here I am talking about him twice now. But he said, thoughts are universally, not individually rooted. And it's just such a perfect example of that. There's a thought in the air. There's a something that's happening. So that here she was in the minister's room. I actually never asked her what was going on. She probably had to cough and get a drink of water, and maybe she decided to use the restroom in the meantime. I don't know, but it was a very long time. And there I was sitting out in the church, and the same exact thought came to us. It was, which is not even the point of why I'm telling you that, but that always amazes me. But I'm telling it to you because when I was just sitting out there meditating and that story came to me again, I realized how meaningful that very knowing, because it wasn't a thought, I didn't figure it out, it came to me. You know, it was more of an inspiration in the moment. Clearly it was an inspiration because Asha got it too. It means it was not really in either of our heads. You know, something was coming to us from somewhere else. But which as soon as we understand that can happen, it does more often. But I was thinking how perfect that is in terms of a talk about love. Because very often, even if we try and describe the word love, I mean, just Google it. I try and Google some of these words sometimes, spirituality. You know, 1,225,000 hits come up to define spirituality. Well, you know, they may as well have as many hits as there are people in the world, because that's what it's like. And love, too. The other night, I got together with a group of people from our community. We watch a movie together every month or every other month. And these, I never pick them out. But the movie that night was called Of Gods and Men, does that sound right? Of Gods and Men, I'm pretty sure that was the name of it. And it's a story about a group of Trappist monks. It's actually a true story. Whether it was taking place in Nigeria or somewhere, they were French Trappist monks who went over to serve people in another country. And then a lot of rebels, terrorists, started coming into this small town where they were. And they had to face this moral dilemma. It's a profound movie, not necessarily easy to watch, but it's so profound, about whether to stay and risk their lives or whether to go. Now, I can't tell you what happens in case any of you watch it, because the ending matters as you watch them work through this. But at one point, this dear, dear monk, who also happens to be a physician, this young girl comes up to him. Maybe she's just in the community. And she says to him, they're just sitting there quietly on a bench side by side. You can tell they really care about each other, but they're not interacting at all. And then she says to him, what is love? You know, just like that. That's one of the opening lines. And here's this monk, you know, who's obviously not been with a woman, at least in many years, if ever. And he starts trying to define love to her. And it's just such a sweet thing, but you hear that it's an indefinable word. You can talk about a feeling, right? I mean, you can say your heart feels this way, or as a friend of mine said to me some years ago, he said, that's it, Shanti, I am on this, I am finding a woman. This is what he said to me. He's a wonderful guy who for some reason never got married, and he just hadn't had a partner in a long time. He said, because you know, I've just figured it out. When you have a partner, your world goes from black and white to color. That's what he said. And I thought, that's a nice way of thinking of it. If it's a good partner, that's the truth. In many ways, you feel like you come alive. But you can't really define the word, because it's an individual experience. You have to have had that feeling. Then all you ever really know about that is what it felt like to you. I mean, you still would be very hard-pressed to want to describe it to anybody else. I know I've gotten to the point in my life when I have a really profound experience, really profound, I don't want to talk about it. Because you say something to somebody about it, and I'll share just an example with you. These stories, by the way, I've taken to always say this when I give a talk, so some of you have heard it. I can only tell you stories about my life because they're the... Well, I have stories about other people's lives, too. But they're not... I'm not telling them to you because I want you to know about me. And I want you to listen to these stories in this way. I'm telling them to you because they're a human experience that I've had, or that other people that I'll tell you about have had. And it lets us all realize what's possible in the world. You know, you just think, oh, if that could happen to her, it could happen to me. Or sometimes it's a hard point to make, and it's easier for me to talk about myself than for anybody to feel like I'm pointing a finger. But the other day I had to conduct what we call it an astral ascension, but it would be called a funeral. But astral ascension just sounds nicer, so that's what we call our little ceremony that we do at Ananda. And this is also very relevant to this topic, which I still haven't started, but I'm going to get there soon. There's a woman in our congregation who's been very peripherally involved, but somehow she and I have had a deep connection. So she'll often go places where I'm giving a workshop, or go away with me for weekends to these retreats or seclusions. So she came to see me a while ago, told me she was getting ready to move to Seattle because a nephew of hers, who she's very close with, she says he's just like my son. She lives with her sister, who's this young man's mother, but she said he's like he has two mothers. He had a child who's 3 years old. Next child was due in July. And he was finishing a fellowship in anesthesiologist. He became a physician. He's about to be an anesthesiologist. First person in his family to really go to school. Their whole cultural background is very mixed. Hispanic, black, a lot of different mixes in there. And he's just the first person to go to school. But she's always said to me, he's just the embodiment of love. She's spoken to me about him a lot. So she calls me about a month ago now and tells me that he was on call one night and he wasn't responding to his pager. And they went and they found him dead in his on-call room at the hospital. 30 years old, about to have his second child, about to finish his fellowship, and he died. And now they've done an autopsy and toxicology reports, and there's no cause of death. They cannot find a cause of death. That's the very sad part of the story. The more upbeat part of the story is that, so last week, so it was 3 weeks after he died, she called me and said a few people in the family wanted to come to Ananda and to have me do one of these astral ascension ceremonies because there really hadn't been a kind of proper funeral in their mind. And I was actually shaken, honestly, to tell you the truth, for two reasons. Number one, most of the people who would come would not know anything about our path, and it's very particular, even the reading that we do when somebody dies. And, you know, in this moment, knowing how shaken these people were, the mother, I mean, all of these, the whole family, the idea of doing anything that would offend them was so difficult for me. So that was very hard for me. But the whole horrific nature of this death, it was just shook me up really a little bit, I have to say. But of course I said, yes, I would do it. But why I'm telling you the story in this moment is that we had this astral ascension, and it was honestly, I'm telling you this is not hyperbole, one of the most profound and uplifting spiritual experiences I have ever had. The family came. One of the aunts, who's a devout Catholic, is just a true saint. So in the way of all true saints, it didn't matter how I was speaking about God or the soul or what happens when we die. She knew I was speaking a truth. It had nothing to do with religion. And the wife, really, the mother, the wife wasn't there, the wife lives in Seattle, but the mother of this 30-year-old suddenly heard what sounded to her as the truth, and this woman who had brought the family together. And so there was this extraordinary connection with this soul that had left and a profound experience of love. Now, here I am telling all of you that story, but the reason I started into the story right now is to say it's hard to share a story like that after the fact, because no matter what I say to you, it's just my words sharing the story. And it was so sacred. I wish I could say, wish the whole world or anybody I cared about could be there so that they could have known what it was and not have to go through these iterations of translation. What does sadness mean to you? What does love mean to you? What does it mean when I say connection with the soul? I mean, so all that happens, and all I want to say is it brought us all to a place where we were in a state of perfect oneness. It was so profound. But remember, I was talking about how do you define love? It's very hard, because I know as I'm speaking that there's no way to guarantee that any one of you have any idea what that experience was like. And when something's so sacred, and sometimes when you just fall in love, whatever that means, I've never quite decided if it was good or bad that we fall into love, but there you have it. Why don't we say we rise into love? Something like that would feel a little more like what we think we'd like to do with all of this, but anyway, we don't. So we don't say that. It's such a unique experience for all of us. It just is unique. But here is one thing I know, just after working with so many people all my life. There's one thing about my practice that I forgot to tell you. I know some of you know this already, but I want to say it for a point here. For many, many, many years, I had the third largest internal medicine practice in the United States. For many years. That is a lot of people to sit and see every day, all day. So if you look at this scientifically and you're talking about a study, and we call the number of participants an N, I had a huge N in this study of life. I've listened to so many people, and it's hard for me to share that with you when I'm up here talking for an hour and a half, but I'm a very good listener. And people just tell you, experience, if you ask them the right questions, if you ask somebody and actually listen for an answer, which I'll talk about later too in terms of how do we love people well, what goes into loving somebody well. But for right now, if you ask somebody a question and actually listen for the answer, people are so eager to tell you their stories. They really are. It's just amazing. I never meet a new client. I didn't when I was actually practicing all that medicine, and I don't now when I take an hour and a half, 2 hours at least with every new person, I sit and I ask them questions. How are you? I let them tell me. How's your relationship? I let them tell me. How are the kids doing? Are you guys still sexually active? Is that good? Is the sex good? You know, were you ever abused? I mean, questions, and people just burst out crying. They just say, nobody has ever asked me. And then they tell you either all of the wonderful news or all of a story they've never had a place to tell before because nobody's ever asked them and listened for the answer, which is remarkable, really. But listening to all those people, what I've come to see, and what many of you will know as well, is that what most of us are thinking we're going to find in love is a setup for disaster. It's just right from the get-go. And I'm not somebody who loves to talk about the negative side of things very much, but in order to really understand love, we have to. Now, whether you think you're somebody who thinks like this or not, let it in, because it is true for all of us. Many of us are looking for, it could be, and in most instances it is, and it's easiest to talk about the partner, whatever the gender of that partner is, let's leave all that out, it doesn't matter, that's going to make us feel whole. That's the easiest way to think about it in terms of relationships. But it's just as true with our children, or sometimes with our parents. You know, how many people have really been able to raise children with a complete understanding that once that child is old enough to take care of itself, you know, to provide for food and clothing, that they're, if from the minute they come in, is the truth, they are who they are. They're on their own. Our job is just to protect them until they can find their way. But if you think about it honestly, how many parents let their children do that? How many parents don't have expectations and needs and projections and so much that gets put on their kids? And in the name of love and family and whatever, we accept a lot of that as normal. How many people in this room could honestly say that you really didn't expect your partner to be a lot like you, to think a lot like you? And really, and I hate to say this, but I will say it, particularly for women, to even become like us. Surely, if they just knew more about how my mind worked, they'd want to be exactly like me. Sometimes my husband has to say to me, honey, you know, in this last hour, and he's very calm, you know, you've tried to explain that to me 6 or 7 times now, and I get it. I actually really get it. I just don't happen to either, fill in the blank, agree with it, want to be it, want to become it. And, you know, it's shocking over and over. Now, I'm making fun of it, but in subtle ways, it's absolutely true. And in subtle ways, we begin to think that our partners, we think it even about friends sometimes if we're not careful. I mean, you can talk about any relationship that you want because it's almost always true. In subtle ways, we really expect people to want to please us, make us happy, give us what we need. Even, again, for women, I don't think men do this as much in the world, anticipate our needs. You know, and sometimes you'll watch men just going like, how would I have known that? And then I have heard myself saying, everybody would know it. And then my husband says to me, are you telling me I'm the only person that you know who wouldn't have known that you would have wanted them to? You know, this starts repeating himself back to me. I feel so silly. It's like, can I just do a rerun here? You know, you want to pull it back in. And this is somebody who tries to live consciously. I mean, who puts a lot of energy every day into trying to live consciously. It is very hard. And the expectations run incredibly deep. It's a very interesting way that we live. This is what we think about love. Many people actually think or feel, I mean, the vast majority of people, and I'm setting this all up for a reason because we have to know what we're really dealing with, where we're starting, even where our unconscious mind is many times, before we can figure out how we might want to change. What do we even want to change from? What would we like to bring to it that would be different? How many people do any of you know who absolutely believe when they're getting married that that's going to solve all their problems? Really? That everything's going to be, people live it over and over and over. We're getting married and everything's going to be perfect. And although they've seen a million marriages, I'm not going to call them imperfect because who's to say what's perfect or imperfect, but that are where there's struggles that go on. Let's put it that way, because that's pretty neutral. Struggles can be wonderful, but how many of us know even one or two, maybe three marriages where there's never an argument, never a struggle? It's almost unheard of. And yet, most people that you see getting married on their wedding day, they cannot fathom that that's going to happen to them because they're in a place where they're just sure. As I heard somebody say once, and I don't remember who it is, men get married thinking the woman's never going to change, and the woman gets married feeling certain that the man is going to change to exactly what she wants him to be. I mean, and we do live this way. I mean, good that we have a sense of humor and we laugh at ourselves, but we really live this way. So we go into relationships expecting the impossible. And again, if anybody gets honest with themselves, in most instances, it's true. Because it's, first of all, not what relationships are meant to do. There's not a human being in the world who can do it, or many human beings who would even want to do it. If we approach somebody and said, look, I want you to come and be with me for the rest of my life, be my friend for the rest of my life, be my child, be my parent, be my partner, and all I'm going to ask is of you is that you live your life where all of your motives are simply to make me happy, to do things the way I want them to be done, to take all of my ideas of what friendship's like, what the whole idea of raising children is like, how we should feel about in-laws or extended family, and just think like I think. Who would want that? So nobody can really do that, besides which there's no guarantees about anything in life, ever. You're 30 years old. You visit with your mother 1 week and you say, I finally made it, Mom. I'm going to work in two hospitals now. I'm finally going to have money. Here's my dream home. This is what I'm going to do. I'm telling you right now, I'm having a game room in the basement because I love games and I'm going to have three kids and here's what's going to go on. And 2 weeks later, you're found dead. You know, it's just, this is life. Things happen. Do people set out to get cancers, to get on the plane that's going to crash, to die in their sleep, to have an affair? You know, you suddenly fall deeply in love with somebody else, or you just simply fall out of love with that person, or you get to be 17 and you don't want to do what your parents want you to do. You just don't. In fact, you feel drawn. You've been raised in a family where they need you to become a professional. It's all they've ever thought. You know, I remember, I've told this story a lot, but it just came into my mind, and it's such a great story. Somebody's going to have to help me with, it came to me. I love that. So Bernie Siegel was an MD, a surgeon at Yale, and he was one of the first people, I forget when that was, like 60s or early 70s maybe, I can't remember. But he started talking about mind and illness, how the mind affected illness. I don't know if Bernie ever got into the whole notion of spirit, which is another whole world completely. But one of his clients, and you know, the doctors thought he was just, they thought he had gone nuts, but he was such a great and well-respected surgeon that they let him I think I just combined two stories, so strike that last comment. I think that was about Paul Brenner, who was the head of OBGYN at UC San Diego. His people did not know what to make of him when he got into things like acupuncture. But it was so out of it in those days, you know, for traditional medicine. But Bernie Siegel was a well-respected surgeon at Yale, and this man came to him who had an inoperable cancer. I'm just trying to go back. I want to make sure I'm telling you the right story for the purpose. Here's the story. I'm sorry I'm doing this. They're all great stories, but they're crossing in my mind. The story is of a man who had severe leg and back pain. This is a true story. Bernie used to bring his patients when he would give talks. So we used to get to hear a lot of his patients in those days, and it was fabulous. And this man, this is the man. This is the last time I'm changing my mind. I'm sorry. I have all these stories, and but it is the story that I wanted to tell you. This is an amazing story. Came to him with a cancer that doctors told him was inoperable. They sent him to Bernie because he was a surgeon who could do these wild surgeries. Bernie said to him after looking everything over, exams, tests, whatever had been done, which amazes me now because I don't even know if we had CAT scans in those days, but anyway, it's true. He said, it's an inoperable cancer. He said, but I'd like to meet with you and talk with you, and he started meeting with this man. And here's what he found out. He found out that when this man came over from Europe on the boats, they were Jewish immigrants, and they came and they landed in New York, and they went down to the Lower East Side where all of the Jews went in that time. And it was just a boon for the Jewish people who were coming out of really having been abused and suppressed in so many different countries, but they could go to the Lower East Side of New York and have these businesses, you know, sewing businesses, or a big business was vegetarian food that would taste like chicken or beef or whatever. They opened a lot of restaurants, and it was all kosher. This is true, and the Lower East Side was completely Jewish. And they were fulfilling the American dream for them. It was amazing. But this patient had been a concert-level violinist from the time he was 5 years old. He was a child protege. He had a Stradivarius at that time that cost like $50,000. I mean, in those days, that was just remarkable. When they landed in New York, his father said, you will not play that piano. That is a waste of time. You will put the violin away, and you'll go into business with me. And the guy grew up doing whatever. I don't know if he was sewing clothes or if he was making vegetarian food or whatever he was doing. I don't remember. But he was sick about it. He loved his music. And Bernie said to him, I want you to go get the violin. And the guy said, I haven't touched the violin in, you know, it was like 40, 45 years. Bernie said, it doesn't matter. Go and get the violin. Literally, the man went, I met this man many times, up to the attic, got the violin, started playing, and the cancer disappeared. This widely metastatic, inoperable tumor disappeared. You know, because this man was led to believe that whatever his parents wanted him to do, I mean, he was a kid. Anyway, he had to do it. We have designs on people. We take this bundle of energy that comes in that has its own karma, if you will. I'm not going to explain that word, but its own path that it needs to follow to be well, to be attuned, centered. And we take that person, whether it's in a marriage or as our child or friends, and we say, no, you have it all wrong. No, you're not going to do that. When it's our children, we can literally say, you're not going to play that violin anymore. Give it to me. We can take it away. But in essence, we live in relationships like that. A lot. And it's not always that violent, and I'm telling you dramatic stories to make points, but in subtle ways, it's really how we live. And it is what we expect. And if we're not careful, those expectations in an unconscious way become our life. And then most means at least over 50%, so I can say it truthfully, are disappointed in life. And we're disappointed in love. And we're disappointed in our children or what they do or choices they make very often. And we don't respect our parents. Now, I know I'm speaking very negatively, and I announced 10 minutes ago I don't like to do that. But it is simply the truth. And if we can just grasp that, then we can start saying two things that I'd like to address here. Number one, what are the ways that we would have, what would come to mind when we think of loving somebody well? What does it mean to love well? And I want to try and answer that question. And the other thing that I'm not going to be able to talk about love without talking about is, who are we in reality? What is our purpose in life? Why are we here anyway, really? And again, remember, just because we might be unconscious of something doesn't mean it's not real. So this takes, perhaps for some of you, an open mind. And as I said early on, when many of you weren't here, perhaps for some of you it'll be offensive, because I will at some point talk about God. And I did give everybody permission to leave if they need to leave. So for those of you who came late, feel free. But because you can't speak about love otherwise, we have to speak about what is the purpose of life, you know? And why are we here at all? And I can say to you without a doubt, some of this is hearsay for me, this I know, the only reason that we come into this body ever to begin with is so that we can continue to evolve spiritually. It's like finding the right vehicle to get us where we need to go, the vehicle that will serve us. You know, in Hindu philosophy, there's always a vehicle. Every little aspect of God has some vehicle that they use, that they ride. And it didn't dawn on me till some years ago. That's really, in essence, what we're all doing. We're a soul who's separated from its source, from a place of oneness. Call that whatever you want. But it's really what happens. It's like trillions of little beams of light going out and becoming everything, whether it's a plant or an animal or a human being. And our job, what we're doing through however many lifetimes, millions I've been told, though I don't know and I don't even remember the last one, never mind 10 ago or a million ago, is really the soul's longing to find its way home, to remember in the very core of its being who and what it is. You know, there's a perfect word for this in Sanskrit, and there's no great word for it in English, but in Sanskrit the word is smriti, because it doesn't mean remembering with your mind, because as soon as your mind is involved, you're separate. As soon as mind comes into it, you've now reduced yourself to this human being again, which is fine. I'm sure you're all perfectly lovely human beings. I sort of think I am too. It's fine. But it's so much less than who we really are. And as long as we're thinking about things, analyzing them, figuring them out, we're limited to this, and we are separate from that place of being one. And the reason that we're here, even though we don't all know this, but the reason that we're here is to take this little ride through however many years we get. It could be 2 weeks for some souls. It could be 30 years for Kristen, who died a few weeks ago. For some of us, for me, it's already 66. Who knows? We don't know. And if we can try and make as much spiritual progress as we can while we're in this body, that's, we've succeeded in this life. So why am I saying that? I'm saying that because, in essence, we are all a part of the same energy. This is very hard for the human mind to get. In fact, it's impossible. That's the nature of mind. But we are all one. In an energetic form, we are all already one. Einstein said, the illusion that we're separate is an optical delusion of consciousness. It's so brilliant. I read a quote last week. I don't remember the man or woman who said it, and I'm going to try and get it right for you. But it says basically that one of the hardest things for us to imagine or realize, and the biggest mistake we make, is that we think that our ability to perceive is the limits of all there is to be perceived. That whatever we can perceive, and we live, and we get so caught up in it, you know? You ever try and deal with a 14 or 15-year-old and tell them that you have anything in the world to teach them? They know everything. They're certain. They know, no, I don't need school. Oh, I know you think marijuana is bad. I know you think it. But look, I know better. I've just spoken to 10 of my friends. But it doesn't matter what it is. And, you know, in essence, we're all like that. We just get older and smarter, and we get more words for it, we get more sophisticated, we don't sound so arrogant, but most of us are, in a way, because we're limited. It's the nature of the human condition, that we're limited, usually, by our mind, until we begin practices that take us beyond mind. Now, one of those practices, which is why I'm talking about it right now, is that if we could imagine every time we looked at another human being, that we were seeing the divine, because we are. It's the truth. We don't even have to lie to ourselves or fake it. It is simply the truth. So if every time we looked at anybody all day long, we looked at somebody and we thought, God, I'm looking right into the eyes of God, or use whatever word you want. I am looking at a pure manifestation of divine energy. Can you imagine how different this world would be? I remember when I was first literally picked up and plunked down on a spiritual path. I had no idea what was happening to me. But I wound up in a conference. It totally changed my life. But one of the speakers there was a woman whose name was Patricia Sun. Perhaps some of you knew her. She was from this area. The woman looked like the sun. She had this head of golden hair. I'm sure it was not her real given name. But she was just wise. Everything she said was wise. My life got changed because of Swami Satchitananda, who was also there. But this woman was really something. But she was giving this talk. There were several thousand people in this place. Neither she nor Swami Satchitananda used the microphone. Every one of us could hear them. Isn't that amazing? That's the first thing that got my attention. Something's going on here that's different than anything I know about. But my husband and I were there because we knew, we had really come to know, we were both in medicine, that the mind and the body were connected, and that you couldn't simply treat somebody's body. You had to know where they were psychologically and emotionally. We had no idea that we weren't even considering spirit yet and how profoundly our lives were about to be changed. We went to this conference. She was talking about love, and I don't know what she said, but somebody raised their hand and said, are you telling us that we should even love Hitler? Now, I was born and raised in a Jewish home. Because I was on a search that I knew nothing about, by the age of 5, I was demanding that my parents keep a kosher home over the holidays. And I used to threaten to run away and go find my grandmother or somebody else if they wouldn't do it. I mean, I was like, I guess, I was kind of timid, but in that instance, I guess I was a holy terror. I was just deciding. So I was really into Judaism. And I was obsessed, as I actually still am, I have to say, with the Holocaust, even though none of my family was killed in the Holocaust. But I don't know. Maybe I lived during the Holocaust. I was born in 47. Maybe I lived through it. I don't really know. But so when she said this, my whole instinct was to get up and leave like that. This woman's going to tell me I'm supposed to love Hitler. But for a few seconds, I sat there, and all of a sudden, I knew it was the truth. She said, more than anybody, this man needs our love. And just like that, she said, oh, Hitler. And I remember, just like yesterday, she put her hands on her, more than anybody, he needs our love. And over all these years now, so many years later, I have so deeply come to understand what she was trying to say. I mean, she said more than anybody, whether that's true or not, but I would say as much as anybody. If we knew that every time we looked at somebody, we were seeing God, then there could never be a reason or a way that they could hurt us, that they could cause fear in us, that they could be doing anything wrong to us. And I want to qualify that, because of course there are people who can hurt us. The whole point of the talk is not to be stupid. You know, we all have to exercise our we have to be relevant and clear, as bring as much clarity, and see what's appropriate in a situation. If you're being abused in a situation, you don't sit there and say, okay, this is God and this person's my teacher. You don't. I mean, you have to see what lesson is God coming to teach you. And in that instance, the lesson might be to get up and get out of that situation. And that might be what you need to learn, because every one of us is on our own path. Every one of us has different lessons to learn. Every single one of us. That's why it's so hard to just give generic advice. I mean, in a way, other than things that are spiritual, it's almost impossible. You know, people call me all the time before they come in and see me and spend money. They say, well, what are you going to do? How do you treat this problem? And I have to say to them, you know, I don't treat a problem. I mean, I treat you. And the truth is, and I say this sometimes in 15 or 20 minutes to help them understand why they would want to come in, I can't tell you what I do that's different for anybody else for your abdominal pain that nobody's been able to diagnose for 15 years. You know, what are you going to do? Well, I don't know. I have to meet you. I need to figure out why you're in pain. And it's different for everybody. And furthermore, how could I possibly know what it is that would help you? How would you take your next steps? They can't be the same for any two people. And what happens when we try and tell somebody to do anything that they're incapable of doing? They just get more frightened, they get more angry, they get more shut down, no matter how much we think it's quote unquote for their good. No matter how lovingly we are sharing information. You know, I had a deal that I made with myself about my husband many years ago. I've told this story many times, so forgive me, but it's very compelling, and I'm going to really shorten it because I have a few points I want to make. But I had a spiritual epiphany many, many years ago when I was about to separate from he was my partner at the time, for about the fourth time, and I was busy telling him why I couldn't be with him for the rest of this life. And it was legitimate. I had a lot of legitimate reasons. By his own admission, he can be really rather difficult, and I could go on, and he would have told you at the time that I was a great partner. I would have told you I was a great partner. But what happened was really compelling for me. It came to me in the midst of that talk about why I had to leave him, that I wasn't leaving him, that he was mine, that there was a lot of karma, it was for karmic reasons, I would be with this man as long as he and I were both on this earth. And not only that, but literally this just came into my head like somebody put it there. Shanti, you never stay where you don't like what's going on or where things aren't good or positive. How are you going to make this right? And the very next image was every time you look in his eyes, every time you will see Divine Mother looking back out at you. That's how I refer to God. You will know that he is God, and you will never see anything wrong with him again, ever. That's what came to me. Whoa, when I sort of came out of that little state, it was like, are you kidding? I mean, to live up to that, but you know what? It was so clearly from somewhere else. And I imagine other people have had that experience. I paid attention. Now, I don't know how many years ago that was, and I'm about to tell you how I didn't hold to that a couple days ago. That's why I wanted you to hear the story. To a large degree, I have. To a large degree, every time I want to go and tell him why he's wrong, what he's wrong about, how I know exactly how he could do it right, do it better, do it my way, I remember that. And how often during the day I just say to myself, you're looking right at God. You are looking right at God. And it's with such a sense of preciousness that it's been years now that I've been telling myself that. It's the truth. I could do it with any one of you. It's always the truth. But about 2 days ago, I got mad at him. And I started out very nicely. Honey, I want to tell you something, but first I want to tell you, you've been so great, and I really appreciate how you've been, and you did this perfectly. And see, I'm just like, here I am. I'm going to be a nice lady. I'm not yelling at you. I'm not criticizing you. But you know, I didn't read that email the way you did. And in fact, you know that habit you have of saying no right away to everything? That's exactly what you did. I read the email, and I go on and on and on until 20 minutes later. I am embarrassed to tell you, we are screaming at each other. I mean, screaming. I thought to myself, I haven't screamed in years. I was screaming. Finally, he says to me, honey, you are right in this moment out of your mind. Stop. He was right. You know, this is, you know, it's not a simple thing. But the truth is, what really got me, in this instance, back into your mind means beyond mind, right? I mean, he's watched how I live. He says to me, something's wrong with you right now. You're just off. He was right because he knows me. I mean, it must have terrified him that I was screaming, you know, because I don't. I mean, I don't feel, I can't imagine what it is that would make me scream. Do you know what I mean? I don't live in that way anymore. Because as soon as we come to understand that nobody really owes us anything, that it's nobody's job to make us happy, that it's only my job to see God in everyone and move closer and closer towards God, and that they're doing exactly the same thing in the very best way they can, how could I ever be mad at anybody? It just becomes almost impossible. Now, it doesn't mean when you go to love somebody well that it always looks pretty. It doesn't mean that at all. What happens when you have to calmly and from a place of being deeply and completely centered say to somebody, no, I'm just not going to do what you're asking of me right now. I'm just not. You know, I have a brother who's very sick. He's got cancer. A year ago, he had a leg amputated, severe peripheral vascular disease, a lot of stuff. And he's been like a son to me. More honestly, I've been like a mother to him. I fly back and forth to the East Coast a couple times a year and just fill in all the blanks. I've always sort of been there for him. And it's a deeply loving relationship. But last year I went when he had his leg amputated and I slept in the hospital with him for a long time. Maybe some of you have heard me tell some of those stories. It was amazing. But for the whole time I was there, I just slept in the chair by his side. It was very sweet. And it was such a deep connection, the way crises often lead to that. And when I got home, I got a call that he had gotten mad at his wife, sort of stormed out of the house, except he didn't have a leg, and they didn't have a prosthesis, and he didn't have it. It was like 10 days out of surgery. And I had said to him, honey, watch your temper when you go home because you know how you are. Don't do anything silly. He fell, broke his cell phone when he fell, laid on the ground for hours, got his wound all infected, went on. So I called him. I waited about a week. He was texting me. I wasn't answering him. And I called him, and I said, you know what? I love you. You know I love you. This is exactly what I said now. I said it. And I said, I don't want to be in a position of judging you. And I don't want to have to tell you how to live your life. Right now, I don't think I can be in your life without being drawn into some of that. So I don't want to talk to you anymore. That's what I told him. I said, I just don't want to talk to you anymore. And when I get ready, I'll give you a call. And you know, people in my life thought that was either, what, loving, honest? I mean, what, I don't know what you would call it. To me, it was just clear. If I was going to keep talking with him, I was going to be drawn in ways that I didn't want to do. And I said to him, I'll call you back when I can, you know, whenever it is, please don't call me. I called him about 5 or 6 weeks later. First thing he did was thank me. Isn't that interesting? First thing, I mean, I didn't even know if he was going to pick up my call. So being real in your love, which also means taking into account your own spiritual welfare. You know, Yogananda, or Swami Kriyananda, who founded Ananda, used to say that over and over. Don't forget in every situation, you have to be concerned about your own spiritual welfare too. That very often could be the most loving thing to do. The most loving thing I could do, short of finding myself being like a screaming maniac, was to say to Rick, I can't talk with you right now. You know, I don't want to be judging whether you're right or wrong, good or bad. I'm just going to step back from the situation. There are times when we need to say no. There are times when we need to not grant everybody's wish. Where that is, remember, we're talking about being either contractive, little, in this body, separate, you know, trying to get everybody else to live in terms of our needs, or worse, trying to live in terms of everybody else's needs, or expansive, growing, using love and this human condition and these human relationships we have as a way of moving forward spiritually. That's all we're trying to do. That is the purpose of every single relationship that we ever have. And if we see it that way, if we can keep thinking of it that way, we're not necessarily here to feel great. Not everything feels great. Probably everybody knows that already. We're here to keep growing. Growing can either can be beautiful and a joy and uplifting and really those moments where you are deeply loving somebody and you feel your heart open and those indescribable moments. Who would think I would have described a moment like that at the funeral of a 30-year-old as one of the most loving moments I've ever known? Because we were one. We were all living with the same truth. And that mother of that 30-year-old came up to me at that funeral. First, she said to me, please come up to the altar with me. I want you to be there. The woman had never met me except a half hour before. I want you to be here while I read a poem to my son that I wrote for him. And then she came and she took my hands as she was leaving. And she said, Shanti, I really had a healing here today. She didn't say, Shanti, you healed me. It had nothing to do with me. We all went to the same place. We all were able to meet in a place that we all knew to be the truth. And it was beyond everything that was happening on the human level. Because on the human level, it's just nothing but a tragedy. There's a 3-year-old, there's a child that's not even born yet, a young wife, a whole life lost. You can't, there's nothing to do with that. There's nowhere to go with that. It's horrible. Unless we know that the purpose of life is to keep growing spiritually and that a soul stays in a body for as long as it can make spiritual progress. And when that time is up, it leaves. And sometimes it leaves when it's 96 and they're saying, I'm ready to go. And sometimes the soul leaves when anybody else is not ready for them to go. And sometimes there's even confusion at a soul level. But as long as we keep remembering what the purpose of life is, then we look at somebody and we say, if I'm going to love this person well, what is it that they need right now? What do they need from me? What are they really asking for? And we don't think we get outside of ourselves to love somebody well. And I would ask you, think about it. How many people in our lives love us like that, that it doesn't wind up being a little bit or a lot about them? Or we go to love somebody and soon it's a little bit or a lot about ourselves. It is such a beautiful practice to try separating ourselves and saying, what do they need? Really, not what do I think they need? Because I could tell my husband, the truth is, if he were ready for it, if it was his time to learn, to see, to experience, boy, you know, there's a very positive way I could react to this person's email. The person who wrote me the email was maybe being a little negative, but I could write back and say, hey, I have a great idea. Here's what we can do with this. Instead, he just says, okay, if you don't want me to work with you, that's it, I'm out of here. That was one response. Okay, goodbye, I'm out of here. Another response is, no, let me just see, wait a minute, because there was a meaningful reason. But the meaningful reason is mostly because as soon as we're ready to find a way to be solution-oriented rather than problem-oriented, find an opportunity there to grow, we could say it many ways. Of course, that's always the way we would want to go. But if I'm standing there yelling at somebody, why didn't you do this more positively? Why didn't you do it better? Can't you see that I'm right? I'm trying to show you how to be a better person. And it's not their time? That's a horrible thing to do to somebody. That person, in this case my husband, who I happen to care about a great deal, had to walk away feeling like he was bad. That's what he said. He said to me, why are you trying to make me feel like I'm bad? And I said to him, that's the most ridiculous thing I've ever heard. That's when I started to scream. But he was right. I was telling him he was bad and wrong. It's so subtle how we communicate like that. So you know what's interesting? When I'm with a patient, I often say, Master, which is what I call Yogananda, or God, or Divine Mother, tell me what to say to this person right now, and how to say it so that they can hear it. That's my prayer often. Now, if you happen to be my patient, you're going to be thrilled that that's my prayer, because I'm asking to tune right into you and give you exactly what you need. Why wouldn't I do that with my husband? Why wouldn't I do that with people that I love the most in the world? Instead, we demand the most, we expect the most, we get hurt the most easily. All we have to do is turn it around and just say, which is what came to me in that epiphany many years ago, you will treat him like you treat every one of your patients, every one of your friends. This is what you do. This is your partner. This is what you will do moving forward. It's so much more, it's the only way to love. It's really the only thing that love is about, is to see the divine in everybody and speak to it. And furthermore, it's the only way that we get to grow. Otherwise, we get to stubbornly hold on to staying right where we are. So let me just say that, first of all, what always holds true is what I was saying before, that we are all individuals. So were I sitting with you one by one, and I will answer the question in a generic way, but were I sitting with you one by one, it would become just meaningful at a different level, because, you know, there's always a lot of story that goes into why we are who we are. And if we could be otherwise, in a way, we would be, of course, but there's something that's driving us forward. And I am going to answer your question, but I just want to say, just today, a woman came to visit me. And this is a complicated story, and I want to make it uncomplicated. But she just had a very difficult experience in a community where she was living, a lot of trouble with some of the leaders, and wound up having to leave there. And she felt unseen, unheard. She felt betrayed. And what's interesting about life is that she was. I mean, in a way, as she told me the story, it was the truth. But I just thought to ask her, she was not a patient, so I said to her, look, I don't want to, you know, dive in if you don't want me, but she just was visiting me and we were talking. She said, no, no, ask anything. So I said to her, I'm just curious about what kind of a childhood you had. Now, I would have answered and spoken to her in one whole way, but then she tells me a story, you know, about a mother who was very meek and sort of almost not present, and a father who was verbally abusive and screaming all the time in the house. And all of a sudden, it just sheds a whole other light on the work that she came in to do at a spiritual level. You know, I'm not a clinical psychologist, so I don't always stay there very long, but you can't answer a question on this without knowing. Having said that, I will say that, first of all, I used to give these workshops around the country. For years I did this, called What Will You Do With the Rest of Your Life? And they were workshops for women between 40 and 60. And those are the only people that were allowed to come. Because women in particular, whatever that karma is that has us come in as women, to a large degree we come in to serve other people. And in many, many women, we do that to the exclusion of ourselves and our own needs. And we do it with our partners. We do it with our children. We do it as physicians, as healers, as whoever we are. It's just, it's so natural. You know, you go away with a group of women and people are tripping over each other trying to serve each other in a certain way. And, you go away with a group of guys, I mean, they see the meals being done. They're happy to sit down and wait for it. It's just, you know, it's just such a different thing in a way, the energy. And I'm not silly enough to, of course, there are many men who get up and serve, and I know that, but we really are, to a large degree, essentially different creatures. So it's our nature to serve. And I think we very often get confused thinking that the more we do that, the better person we are. Or as long as there's a need, it's like a knee jerk. You know, it's like a reflex. There's a need, we're going to fill it. And we even can be getting angrier and angrier and angrier about it, but we keep doing it. Or we do it to the point where we feel depleted. So I just say that this is a big issue in certain ways. And then you're a physician, and that makes it, I mean, that just adds to it. You know, because all we're taught is to serve other people, you know, to be there. I used to go to bed. I used to work 18-hour days, 7 days a week. I did it for years and years and years. And whenever I would go to sleep, I would say to my husband, no matter when I go to bed, there's five more people thinking I should call them. And you know what? I should. They really should hear from their doctor today. But at some point, you just got to go to sleep and get 3 or 4 hours sleep. So it's complicated. The only way to heal ourselves from that is to begin activities that really help us get centered back in ourselves. And far from being selfish, it's the most expansive, generous, giving thing we can do. First of all, we have to take care of our own spiritual welfare. I'm not speaking about being selfish and self-involved or narcissistic or, you know, angry. I've taken care of you for enough. Now it's my turn. What does that mean? You know, that's crazy. We did what we wanted to do because we love doing it. Then one day I said to my partners, you know what? I don't want to work like this anymore. And they looked at me and said, what do you mean? I said, I'm done. I'm done working 18 hours a day. I'm done having 6,000 people think that they have immediate access to me. It's been perfect, and it's not perfect anymore. And they said, what are you doing? I said, 6 months to find another doctor. I'm leaving. We found 2.5 doctors to take my practice, but I left. You know, but what are those practices? And I mean, that's where it's hard to know. Bernie Siegel said, go and get your violin and play, and the cancer went away. I frequently write prescriptions for my patients that'll say something, and it depends who they are. The bottom line here, which is the bottom line of any talk I ever give anywhere, the only way to know these things is through meditation. It's the only way. We can't think our way there. We can't analyze our way there. We can't process our way there. We can make progress. We can really move far down the road. But you can't transcend the mind with the mind. It's a virtual impossibility. The mind, it's its nature, it's its job in the world to hold us back. So, and I know that's hard to get, but it's simply the truth. We have to find a technique that allows us to get out of our minds. And then, Smriti, we remember who we are with our whole being. I never finished that thought. That's what I was saying. That in the English language, memory means something we do with our mind. No, we want to get out of our mind. In Sanskrit, Smriti means suddenly our whole being knows exactly who it is. We remember we are one with everything. But we're one with everything in this individual body for now. We have to live in this material reality. That's our job. We can't, otherwise we run around like airheads, you know, thinking what? We have to be in this world, live in this body, take responsibility. So I think whatever it is, I write prescriptions for people who have wanted to paint for years and they haven't, wanted to play an instrument, wanted to be on the beach twice a week, but they haven't been to the beach in 7 years. You know, it's like that. Those are the kind of prescriptions I write. You must go to Carmel with your partner one weekend every other month. You know, those kinds of things. Leave the kids with your parents. I mean, whatever it is. You know, go take your paint up and sit up on Skyline Drive and paint, or go to Half Moon Bay, or go anything. And it sounds silly, but it's not at all silly. It's discovering, it's reconnecting with that energy that is exactly who we are. And it's not like what you've been doing is bad. It's wonderful, but not once we feel depleted, angry, resentful, nothing good in that. We can only give what we have to give. It's essential about loving. Don't give any more than you have to give. I remember Swami Satchitananda wrote a beautiful, sweet little book. It's called Beyond Words. It's been out of print for years, I think. And in it, he tells this story about a man who wanted to help everybody. And he was called to a fire, and he said he had a bucket of liquid. It sounds silly, in his hands. And he went and threw it on the fire, but it turned out it was gasoline. You know, not water. We have to know, what do we have to give? Do we have the right thing? And ask ourselves, we have to give ourselves permission to be loving with ourselves. And first, so the first step here is self-honesty. Do I have something to offer here or not? Am I in a place to offer it? Am I centered enough? Should I even answer right now? You know, so many times in my life when I don't become a screaming maniac with my husband, I'll say to somebody, this is a great discussion for us to have, but not right this minute. I even said it to somebody who works, not really for me, but with me, but I happen to be the manager. And they were asking me a question the other day, and I said, it's a perfectly good question, and I am glad you're asking it. She wanted to ask something of me in terms of work. I said, but you know what? We just shouldn't have this conversation today. I'm really busy. I'm feeling a little frazzled, and this conversation's going to go much better. And it's just a simple little example. I remembered that time to do it. But if we could all do that, if we could all say, where am I really? What would I love to do with my life? What do I really have the energy for? You know, when is time for us to slow down? When shouldn't we be working 18 hours a day anymore and thriving on it? I was thriving on it. But it's not shouldn't. We shouldn't do it as soon as we're not thriving. Yes, this was perfect, and now it's not. So now I need a change. Now I'm going to love seeing 500 patients in my medical practice, which I did for another few years, a different practice. I moved. I opened a little practice of 500. Suddenly 500 people. What am I doing taking care of 500 people? And I moved to where I am now. You know, I mean, it's just, it's hard to pay attention. But I think that's what I would say to you is whatever. I would definitely recommend that if you don't meditate, that you take a meditation class or do some yoga. It really, those, all of those techniques are designed to get us into our center. You know that phrase, centered, came into being in the 60s. And it wasn't that many years ago that I understood what it meant, because right at our very core is what's called our astral spine. It's as real as our anatomic spine, just mostly we don't see it on X-ray or CT scans. But it's really that central core of energy that wants to just flow up, and we each have our own blueprint, and it flows through these vortices of energy called chakras, and everything that we can do to allow that to just flow unobstructed, we start feeling more and more centered. It's like, oh, this is right. Wait a minute. No, I was not supposed to say to the next three people who called today, sure, I'll see you. No. I wasn't supposed to just extend myself. Or I could actually sit here and listen while this person shared a little longer than I really had time for, because I'm centered. I'm in my spine. And when we get there, I hope I've told enough stories of myself to let you all know I'm not always there. But I'm always wanting to be there, and I'm always coming back when I stray. We have to live consciously. Learn to take responsibility for ourselves and to be as kind and loving and generous as we can be and not overextend ourselves. It's just really essential. Well, I think, you know, people ask me all the time, how do you know? How do you know? And I think every one of us has the ability to sit quietly enough and ask ourselves, try it on. I have three jobs that I'm choosing. You know, if I choose this one, what does it feel like inside? Or look what it's like if you mistreat people, you know, or when you're about to go. I love it when people say to me, and I hear it all the time, I'll be talking to somebody and they'll say, I don't know how it happened, I just found myself there. I hear it more often than not about getting into bed with somebody. I just found myself in bed with this person, I don't know how it happened. What do you mean you just found yourself there? How do you just find yourself in situations in life? You know, but to really get conscious and clear and make conscious choices. And they don't always have to please everybody. They may not even really be pleasing to you. You know, recently I've really come to understand that having to work sometimes with people who are not the most pleasant or who are competitive or just things, and sometimes I say to myself, what difference does it make? Let me try and not deal with them here. Let me try and look up here. You know, this is a soul who's trying their best. Now again, you can hear I have very clear limits. I tell my brother, who's like a son, I don't want to talk to you for a while. I tell people all the time when they start conversations with me, when they just want to, I don't like to just chatter about, you know, about, and I'll say to some of my friends, you know what, this conversation isn't being good for me. Let's change the subject. Well, you know, that's hard for people. They go, oh, okay. But I mean, I feel like otherwise, you know, I just don't want to talk about all this negative, dark gossip. I just don't want to be there. Or I say to them, you know, I'm not really enjoying the conversation. I'm happy to leave, or we can talk about something else. You know, usually they don't say leave, although they'd probably like to. I mean, it sounds crazy, but, you know, at what point do we really, you know, every single human being Every single human being is pure energy. Energy is magnetic. So every person we ever meet has a magnetism. We have to ask ourselves consciously, do I want to be drawn in? Because if their magnetism is greater than yours, you lose. If they're on a downward spiral, you go down. To ask yourself, can I grow here? Is this a relationship I'm going to enter into where I will be able to become more than who I am in this moment? In any way. That doesn't mean it's always easy. Maybe you have to take care of a parent that's bedridden for the last 6 months of their life. That's not a joy. Maybe your partner has a stroke and you take care of them for the rest of their life. Not a joy. But will you grow? Will you be more expansive? And the other thing is to try and make conscious choices. Once you decide to do something, do it with joy. As I said, just tell yourself all the time, I'm serving God. I'm serving God. I'm serving God. You can't say it enough. Then whatever you're doing becomes, and if that phrase doesn't work for you, I'm opening my heart. I'm opening my heart. Plug it in the way it makes sense to you. But if you're going to stay somewhere, in a relationship, in a job, whatever it is, make it good. Decide how you're going to grow there. And the minute you feel that you can't be drawing energy up and out, ask yourself, is it time to leave or what changes do I need to make? And I'm not advocating leaving at the drop of a hat by any means. And I'm saying sometimes stay for the hard stuff and sometimes don't stay. Swami Kriyananda was once told a story. There was a woman who stayed married to a man for 7 years, and he was so opposed to her spiritual path, he was mean about it. Every time she would sit to meditate, he would like turn the television up. I don't remember because I didn't hear it, but I heard Asha tell this story. Swami said when he heard that, when she was leaving the marriage. It's not exactly most spiritual teachers' role to help you out of marriages. But he said, I would have left after 5 minutes. We can't stay in places where the magnetism does this to us. It's not right. Nobody wants that of us. We either have to find a way to make it this, which very often we can do. We don't leave too early. Very often we can raise the energy. And if we can't, then we say to ourselves, is it time to make a change? I watch people suffer in jobs for years and years and years. I think to myself, oh my God, of course you're sick. Of course you have backaches or headaches or chronic abdominal pain or whatever it is. Of course, you hate where you are. The story that I didn't tell about this man who had this chronic severe pain in his leg, nobody could ever find anything. I mean, they did so many tests on this man. This was another Bernie Siegel story. And finally, this man started talking to Bernie about how much he hated his job. He despised his job. He said, I've been there 30 years. I've hated it every day. And Bernie said, no wonder you have all this pain. You can't stand where you're sitting. You know, get out of there. And, you know, it's amazing how it takes courage. I know that. Believe me. Life was never meant to be easy, right? But if we do those things that take us in that direction, instantly healing sometimes, instantly, of the most amazing conditions. So I promised the front desk people that we wouldn't do what I always do when I'm here, which is people leave here at 9:30, 20, 10. They say, oh, you remember Dr. Rubenstone? We know you're here so much. We really like to have everybody out at 9 o'clock out of this classroom. So time for one or two more questions, and then we really should go. Yes?
You mentioned that the woman may journey to serve, and I wonder if woman can be a server and a leader in doing at the same time?
Yes, absolutely. That would be the balance. A server, a leader, and somebody who knows how to take care of herself. Because in taking care of herself, she will have so much more to give others. It's the only way to give others. When you feel depleted, it means you've disconnected yourself from this infinite source of energy. We have to find a way to plug back in. Oh, but absolutely. Oh, I love serving. I am a quintessential mother, nurse, doctor, minister. No, I mean, I would shrivel up and die if I didn't serve. So, and many people would. You're born to be a server. You have to do that. But it doesn't mean you give your whole self away, is all we were talking about. Does that make sense? Yeah. Anybody else? Okay. Thank you all for being here. Wonderful.
Thank you. Yeah. Thank you.